Hi, I'm Mike Nagrant, and you're listening to Hungry Magazine from Chicago, Illinois.
4, 3, 2. One
more time. Hey there, welcome back to another week with Hungry. I'm excited to bring you a new development in Hungry Magazine land. I'm now producing a separate podcast for Chicago Magazine, which I'm really excited about. They've got a great magazine, and they got their ear to the ground for the local Chicago food scene. So if you're looking for more Hungry-style podcasts, hop on over to chicagomag.com. This week I sit down with Cameron Hughes, the man some folks are dubbing the Robin Hood of wine. Hughes is a negotiant. He owns no vineyards, makes no wine, but he has an inside connection to some of the best wineries that do. The way the model works is many top wineries produce wine that either doesn't fit into their profile or they make too much of a particular wine. That's where Hughes steps in. He buys up the excess lots and then markets them under his own label, Cameron Hughes Wines, and sells them direct on his website and through Costco. The only catch is he can't name the wineries that the wine he bought came from. So in theory, though not likely, you could be drinking excess wine like an Opus 1 for $10, but you wouldn't know it. Because Hughes bypasses traditional middlemen and marketing fees, he's able to offer incredible wines for about $10. Now, I know this all sounds too good to be true. I was really skeptical at first. I'm very concerned about craftsmanship, and it seems that if this excess wine was any good, it would be selling, or the wineries would market the wines themselves. Furthermore, I didn't happen upon the story myself. I was contacted by a publicist, which happens a handful of times a day. 9 times out of 10, the publicists are shilling and I turn them down. Frankly, I don't know why I decided to listen to Hughes. I guess part of it was the $2 chuck or the Charles Shaw cheap wines phenomenon. While I don't drink it every day, you know what? It's a good drinkable wine and it's cheap. So I was curious why I'd want to pay more. You know, is a $10 wine going to be better than a $3 wine? And so as you'll hear in the interview, there is no comparison. Hughes wines are superior to Charles Shaw, and only for a few bucks more. The good news is, if you're in Chicago, the Hughes wines are now coming to the Costcos this weekend, August 18th, 19th, and 20th. Cameron Hughes will be there himself, actually, selling the wines and discussing what he does. My personal favorite was Lot 14, a nice spicy 2003 Merlot. Let's go to the interview.
So I know I thought one of the interesting things was you started with the wine group, or you worked with the wine group, which notoriously, of course, is do they represent Franzia, I think?
They do, but notoriously, they're not notorious because Fred Franzia has nothing to do with the Franzia brand.
Okay.
Yeah, Fred actually, his father sold it off. And Fred was like, oh, Dad, what are you doing? You know? So he started up his own company, and which is now called Bronco, which stands for Brothers and Cousins. Mm-hmm. And that's the guy Fred always gets in trouble for doing this and that. And latest thing was to buy these Napa Ridge brands that were put in, or rather made with Napa grapes, and then start putting Central Valley Planc in there and marketing it. This guy still makes good wine. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't call it Planc because he's a value producer.
Sure.
And he's a guy, he's a self-distributor. Right, so in California, he distributes his stuff himself direct.
Sure.
He built Trader Joe's wine program. Built it. I mean, gave him all sorts of private labels to run with, and that's how Trader Joe's got started. This guy built their business for them. And then, of course, now he's a progenitor of $2 Chuck, much to Charles Shaw's chagrin, because Charles Shaw still lives to this day. It's kind of like this East Coast, very proper, very prim, and the guy was just devastated. Mm-hmm. Really, apparently, a nice guy. Devastated that his name turned into this $2
sure.
Chuck thing.
Sure.
His wife got his name or his wine brand in a divorce settlement. And then, hating him, promptly sold it to Fred Franzia. So that's the inside scoop.
Yeah, but, I mean, is that a bad thing? I mean,
nope.
The wines are not that bad.
Not that bad. They're totally drinkable. I think the quality, it was stellar out of the gate. They really had some dynamite juice going in there that they were buying up so dirt cheap. But that stuff's all gone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not out there anymore.
I think that brings up the idea of, I think people call you 10 Clam Cam, and there's all these markers because people like to be cute. And,
yeah, totally.
But, of course, that kind of brings up comparisons in terms of the value proposition.
The business model's the same. It's the same business model. They work the bulk wine low-end business. They buy whatever excess they can get their hands on. And they bring their own party to the table as well, because Fred Franzia owns 30,000 acres of grapes. So what we do that's different, though, is we work the high end of the business.
Mm-hmm.
Small lots of high-end juice that, for a variety of reasons, wineries sell off. Cash flow, excess blending components. They're still high-quality wines. They just didn't fit into a particular blend. They don't have a use for it. And then discontinued vineyard projects, the first wine we ever put into Costco. The lot number one Lodi Syrah went I had access to that wine from a buddy of Duke, or he had tried for several years to market a $30 Lodi Syrah, particularly out here in the East Coast where he's from and where his customers are, but he just couldn't get arrested with Lodi on the label. Mm-hmm. Syrah is hard enough at $30. You throw Lodi on there, it's virtually unmarketable. So he was spending all his money tasting people on it to get them to buy it. So he discontinued that project. We bought his 02 and 03 that he had in barrel, and that's the first wine we opened up Costco with. I basically went in there and begged them to taste it. I didn't even go in there. I just got the guy on the phone after months of trying. And I can tell you the whole run-up to that, but it was like, I guarantee you're going to buy this wine.
Sure.
Guaranteed. I will never call on you again. I can never call on you again. And he's like, okay, kind of laughs at it. Just drop it off. If I get to it, I get to it. Calls me up the next day, says, I'll take everything you got.
Nice.
And that's how we got started.
How many calls? How long of a process did you take?
Oh, it took... Well, we started out probably... I had built a whole new brand concept that I wanted to roll out nationally, and it hit me in August when my main broker, who was setting all this stuff up, had been basically telling me that he was getting all these appointments, and I was calling the buyers, and they had never even heard from the guy. I'm just like, holy cow, this whole project is just, it's a ghost ship in the night. There's nothing happening here. I mean, it's being held up by nothing. And so I said, oh, God. So I immediately went back and got a consulting job through the end of the year and just hung up everything. But what I realized was I needed a new business model. And so I started calling all the major chains out in California and saying, I knew I had access to small lots of killer stuff. And I just called up these guys and I said, look, you know, I'll present live tank samples to you. You buy off. And they're like, nah, you know, we don't need this stuff. And I thought Trader Joe's would go for it, mm-hmm. you know. But they're like, listen, we do this already.
Right.
You know, we have guys that do this for us. We don't need you. And I said, mm-hmm. you don't understand. I get stuff that other people don't get. Mm-hmm. And they're like, nah, no thanks. So I finally got this Costco guy. It took months and months. I'd been trying since probably October. And one day I just called at like 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And sure enough, he picks up. You know, he's expecting another phone call from somebody else because they don't pick up their phones. Yeah. You know, they get messages and they'll call you back if you're important. I mean, can you imagine? There's thousands of different wine producers on the planet. They all want to get into Costco. So I gave this guy my best pitch. I said, I guarantee it. I'm down on my knees. I'm telling you, you're going to buy this wine. And because I'm going to sell it to you at this price, and you're going to sell it here, and it's $30 juice. He said, oh, all right, drop it off. If I get to it, I get to it. Next day, calls up, so I'll take it off. So that's how we got started. It took about 6 to 8 months after that, though, to get the label put together that was approved by them. A friend of ours designed this label. It's kind of an elegant package. We wanted it to look kind of upscale, you know, but sell downscale, price point-wise. And once we got it in, we blew it out 6 weeks. They were like, holy cow, you know. And we were only in like 8 stores. And 1,800 cases, we blew it out in 6 weeks. And they were like, let's do that again. I said, well, I just happen to have lot number two, Dry Creek Zinfandel. I went out on a limb and bottled that one up as well. And I bought that from the same guy. He had gotten it from a cousin who was making the wine, and he just kind of brokered a deal between the two of us. And then we started presenting live tank samples.
I'm curious what your edge is. You're like, well, I know these people that nobody else knows, or, you know.
Yes, that's it. You know, it's through the grapevine. There's a lot of deals that get done that way. But what immediately happened after we got the first wine is a couple winemakers came to me and said, we can help you do this better. We see what you're doing. And there's like, we've been sourcing high-end. And through people, you know, they kind of heard about me. And these guys said, you got to go see what this kid's doing. And so they've taken over all the sourcing. So I don't have to go sit and do all this stuff. These two wines got me up and running, and then these guys came in and they've taken over the back end of the project. They work on a per case basis, and they're amazing. They know everybody, and the key is to know when guys are releasing wines. Mm-hmm. Okay, so X person is doing their barrel blend in. You know, most of them do it in the springtime. That's when, like, say, like right now, everybody's blending their 04s and bottling their 04 Cabernets. So you know that there's going to be a lot of 04s on the market all of a sudden. These guys know, and they work with the big brokers as well to get this stuff. But that's the key. And the fact that we sign contractual obligations to not talk about where it comes from. There's a lot of negociants that do it that way. And there's also guys that, you know, will come in and they'll go out and they'll say, hey, I've got Silver Oak in the bottle here, or I've got Schaefer leftovers, or I got Ferrari Carano leftovers, and they'll go out and they'll talk it up in the marketplace. They won't get those wines again. Sure. Yeah, they'll get a phone call.
Sure.
Hey, yeah. You ever want to do this again? Shut up.
Sure.
It happened to be my first wine. I was out saying, hey, I got X in the bottle, you know, and I got a phone call real quick, and I learned.
One of the reasons they would do that, of course, is because these are the ones that didn't fit their flavor profile, these wines, or they're wines that were excess. And so in some ways, they've made the decision that this doesn't represent their brand or what they're used to.
That's often the case. Go ahead.
I guess I just want to play devil's advocate a little bit. I mean, right. The idea would be, I mean, you're a business guy. It's all about the marketplace. And the idea it would be, you know, if these wines had value, you know, why wouldn't the winemakers sell them off themselves? Or why isn't there a demand for them, you know, or whatever it is, you know?
There's a huge bulk wine business to start off with. Guys are buying, selling, trading wine all the time. And the way wine gets made, okay, you got a vineyard. You may have 7 different Cabernet blocks. Each block has a slightly different soil type, different rootstock, different clone. Okay, so the rootstock talks to the earth, the clone talks to the sky. All right, and they're done, they're genetically bred to have different flavor profiles. So at the end of the day, winemakers bring in the wine by block. Okay, sometimes they'll vinify those wines separately, or they always vinify them separately. They go into small lots, sometimes get different pump over treatments, different barrel treatments. So at the end of the day, they have all these different lots of wine to choose from to put their blend together. Now, the leftover lots just didn't fit in. It may not be, it has nothing to do with flavor profile. It just didn't fit into the blend the way that it was made. That's more typically the case. So those wines then get sent a tank sample to a broker or to one of my winemakers, and who then, you know, we'll reach out to others. We'll get a whole bunch of different samples. You know, they go down, they sit down with the brokers, and they'll put a blend together there on the spot. They present it to me ASAP. If I like it, I'll get a whole bunch from them. You know, they'll put 7 or 8 wines in front of me. If I like it, I immediately take it down to Costco. Costco will then sign off on a tank sample. If they like it as well, they feel that it fits into their marketing as well. I mean, they have to, you know, they don't want, if they've already got another $9.99 Napa Valley Merlot, they don't want this $9.99 Napa Valley Merlot until the other one's sold out. And so we run into things like that.
Well, I'm curious about it because part of it's marketing, sure, but the other thing is in the end, people are going to keep coming back for wines because they taste good and they meet what they like. And
yes.
And so in some ways, you're trusting your palate, but you're also kind of projecting what the palate, the collective palate is, or what people like. And I guess I was curious about what you think about when you're, what's the profile of a Cameron Hughes wine, or, you know, what's the profile you think people are really interested in nowadays?
I think for our program in Costco, we do typically mostly reds. We're getting back into the white wine business. We do want wines that sometimes, like, for instance, we had a Dry Creek Cabernet. We blended in a little Napa Valley Merlot, but it was still reflective of a Dry Creek Cab, tasted like a Dry Creek Cab. And so we'll do things like that. But typically, we tend to go, we try to drill down to Appalachian. So this is the Napa Cab that we have here is 66% Rutherford, a little bit of Oakville, a little bit of Pope Valley. But it's mostly Rutherford as a base wine. This is Stag's Leap Cabernet. So we do try and drill down to those Appalachians. So when we're looking for a wine, we're looking for something that it's not necessarily reflective of terroir, okay, because we're blending different components together. You know, they're from different vineyards, so you can't really shoot for that. But for the reds, we tend to shoot for a California-style, big, rich, muscular, full body, but well-balanced. It's a big, ripe wine, though. They're not, you know, we're not talking about age these wines for 20 years. These Stag's Leap Cab and this Rutherford, you will see, have a lot of aging potential on them. Okay, but they're not acid bombs.
They're big fruit bombs.
Yeah, they are. They are. The big, rich, but they're balanced. They have good structure. And through blending, you can do that. When I taste a wine, it's not so much about what the taste is, as long as it's clean, right? It's fine. It's not barnyardy. You know, it doesn't smell like, you know, it doesn't have any off components. As long as it's clean, I look more for structure. That's really what I look for. I need a wine that's well-balanced, it's got good acid, it's got good tannic component, and it's got a balance of wood. It's not overdone in any direction. I look for structure. It should coat your mouth, and it should hit on all vectors. It should kind of go upwards and lift out when it's on your palate. And there are certain white wines that should slice like a knife. Riesling should just come right down on your tongue like a gray dull knife, or a gray sharp knife, rather, and just cut right through. So we do shoot for big, rich, muscular on our reds. However, we've got Russian River Valley Chardonnay coming. Not a lot of oak on it because that's Russian River Valley Chard. It's got tremendous soft acids. It's full-bodied. It's rich, but it's not. It's a Russian River Valley Chard. You can lay this stuff down. We have an Edna Valley Chardonnay. It tastes like Santa Barbara Central Coast stuff. So we do try to be specific to where it comes from. It should taste like that stuff. You know, we shouldn't have a low-acid, full malolactic Russian River Valley Chardonnay with 2 years of new oak on it. that's not what we're shooting for. I don't think that's reflective, and that's not the best way to make wine in the Russian River Valley. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where our style. And we have a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc coming. Mm-hmm. We have Clare Valley Riesling coming. And these are very reflective of where they come from, their typicity. We hold that through in our brand. We're buying the same wines that you're going to get in these other labels.
So are you guys actually doing the blending, or you're tasting blends, or how does that work?
I have guys that do it for me, and then I get all the samples sent to me. I taste through, and I go, here's what I like, or I tell them, I like this wine, however, it needs such and such. You need to enrichen this up, or the finish is short, it's dull, and it lifts up off my palate, and it's hot on the roof of my mouth. We need to round this down and stretch it out a bit. And they know exactly what I'm talking about, and they know what to do. They know what wines to use to do that. It's all about chemistry. The blending is all about chemistry. You can really put lipstick on a pig and make it work. Mm-hmm. You really can. I hate to put it in those terms, but it's all about chemistry. And you can take a wine and throw 3% of something in it, and it just changes it tremendously because the pH changes. That allows the wine to do its thing.
Sure. And a lot of these wines are wines that they would use in the back blending process to make lesser wines taste better, right?
That's right. So other negociants work. What I work with are what are called silver bullet or fixer wines. Mm-hmm. So these are the real high-end cuvées. They're excess component. High-end winemakers always make more than they need. They always do. There's always leftover from these guys, be it a barrel, be it 200 barrels. So these wines, we'll buy them up. We'll put blends together. We always blend like quality with like quality. We never blend to increase volume. Mm-hmm. Okay, some wines are 1,800, some wines are 2,700, some are 12,000. We don't ever change that. But the other negociants, they're trying to blend to have a wine that lasts all year in their sales channel. Then they also have to sell through the three-tier distribution system. Their cost of production has to be half the price of mine to hit the same price point because I sell direct. I cut out all the middlemen. Even here in Chicago, we have guys clearing the wine into the state for us at less than one-fifth, less than 20% of what it would cost to clear it in normally, because Costco has them to, and Costco has the leverage. Guys just want to back their truck up to Costco in the wine business. Just backing up to Costco is a privilege, because then you can get other stuff in. If you're already going in, Costco wants to limit their vendors to those guys that matter to them.
And the thing I think about with that, of course, is you hear a lot about the Walmartization of America.
Yep.
These big powerhouses who mm-hmm. have the negotiating power. I know, for example, I've got a lot of friends in the design industry.
Yep.
And they talk about how when you're designing a new product, you're kind of designing to what Walmart wants because that's where you're going to sell a lot of units.
Yeah.
So I know that you were looking for good wines, but at the same time, I wonder, is there a pressure, is Costco looking for a specific wine, or are they doing something, or are they influencing the American palate, as far as wine goes? What do those guys look for? Are these real wine guys, or are these guys who are looking for the bottom line?
Imagine you're a Costco wine buyer. You don't stand in the store, all right? You've got only a few ways to sell the wine. One of them is information. So if you're a Costco wine buyer, wines that are well-reviewed, and then wines that you like. So they rely heavily on the Enthusiast, Spectator, and Parker, okay, to provide, to score wines. Well, they rely on their scores to help them sell wine.
Right.
Because they're a lean, mean producer. Or Costco's a lean, mean organization. They can't stand in there. They're higher-end stores. They now have wine stewards in, guys that can recommend, guys that taste the wines and all that. Are they affecting the U.S. palate? I'd say probably the Spectator and Parker definitely have more influence than those guys do.
Sure.
But Costco is getting big, man. They're selling a lot of wine, no doubt about it. And they're selling a lot more high-end wine. They're going up and up and up. In California, they just dedicated all the – they have this huge floor space for wine. Department 16, which is their wine section, is probably one of the most profitable centers in a Costco store. Mm-hmm. So they're expanding that. But they're cutting down on their floor items, and they're chopping out anything below $6.99, I think it was, or $7.99. It's all gone. That's it. They're all gone. All those $2.99, $3.99, $4.99 Chardonnays that they had, they're all gone. And they doubled the amount of boxes. So Costco's going upscale. They're going high-end. But they sell wine in a variety of different styles in there. I've had no oak Chardonnays in there, Albarinos, Rieslings. Mm-hmm. They're getting into more and more stuff. But I don't think they're influencing the American palate so much as the wine writers are.
One other thing I wondered about was, since we were talking about $2, is that people have gotten used to going to Trader Joe's and spending $3 for a wine that they drink every day. And
yeah.
I wondered if that's made it hard for you. I mean, you're at the $10 price point, and it's like people are like, well, I expect a $5 wine now, or is that not the case? Or
not the case for our stuff. Yeah. You know, when we tell them about what we do and how we do it, and we talk about, you know, there's a neat graphic that breaks down a $25 bottle of wine,
yeah,
that the Spectator posted before. And it basically said on a $25 bottle, less than 17% of that 25 bucks is the actual cost of the wine itself, mm-hmm. which is crazy. And so for us to get into the higher quality stuff, you're going to have to pay for it. However, the difference between, and I'll answer your question, I'm getting
sure,
there. The difference between a $10 bottle of wine, which costs about $2.50 to manufacture, and then a $100 bottle of wine, say Opus 1, is about $5 in manufacturing costs. Mm-hmm. That's about it. Maybe $6, you know. So it doesn't cost a lot to make this stuff. So are people getting used to the $3 bottles? You can't get this quality at $3. Mm-hmm. You can't. You're going to get... You know, in $2 Chuck now, you're probably getting a $5 or $6 bottle of wine for $1.99 or $3 out here in Chicago, okay? But we do the same metric. Basically, we knock about, through selling direct, you can knock, and selling direct to a retailer who works lean, like Costco, which is about a 12, 13% margin, they're basically breaking even on this stuff. You can knock about 66% off the retail price that way. We're not having any resistance in our program in Costco. People are buying this stuff up faster than we can make it.
Mm-hmm.
No kidding. I can't. I've been out of wine for a month. I've got these three wines to sell right now. I've got some stuff coming in from South Africa right now. Stellenbosch Cabernet, Stellenbosch Merlot that we'll be selling. And until those get here, I don't have any wine to sell.
So what's the impetus? People are tasting them when you guys are going into the stores?
No. We talk about our program. We tell them what we're doing, and we just get them to try it. You know, just take one home. It's Costco. If you don't like it, you can bring it back. You know, we try not to promote that fact. I should keep my mouth shut about that. But, you know, people know that at Costco, Costco does not carry dogs, mm-hmm. right? There's nothing in there that's bad. And when we talk about how we do what we do, we tell them, listen, under other labels, the same juice is $25 or $30, or in the case of the Stag's Leap, you're looking at $45 quality Stag's Leap Cabernet here. You're only paying, say, $13.99 or $14.99 for this, or $9.99 in the case of the Napa Valley Merlot, which out here, I'm sorry, translates to $11.99. They're like, all right, I'll try one out. And you'll see the sales the next day. You may sell 30, 40 cases that day of sure. single bottles. The next day, they're selling another 20, 25 cases. People coming back to grab more. And that's how, and the key component for our program, what's made us successful at Costco, is our email list. We got probably 5,000 people in Northern California alone mm-hmm. that are on the list. When we send out a list, Costco blows out 1,000 cases a day until mm-hmm. the stuff's gone. They just decimate the inventory because they know, hey, anything Cameron puts out, it's going to be a dynamite deal. And if I don't like it, you know what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how we've built the program. And it's that mailing list that drives it to get people out in the street and let them know this stuff's out there. Mm-hmm. It's been amazing. And we're going to do the same thing here in Chicago.
Sure.
Start the mailing list. When I'll be in, I think, Oak Brook tomorrow, Lincoln Park on Saturday, and then Glenview on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And we'll have a mailing list. We just sign up, you know, 100 people a day. And when we send in the new releases and then they tell their friends, it's totally been grassroots.
How'd you get into wine? Was it purely the early stuff?
My dad got me into it. He's been in the biz a long time. On the sales side, started out working for Gallo, and then I spent the last 30-some-odd years with a company called The Wine Group, who, as we mentioned before, Franzia, Corbett Canyon, Mogan David. I mean, used to sell Mogan David 2020. I mean, that was back in the days, man. And I remember he used to bring home these test things like called Rainbow Rim, and just, oh, my God, he'd be howling at the moon by the end of the night. Nasty
you,
stuff.
I had a lot to drink in college.
Yeah, I know. I can't tell you a lot. I was down in Delaware one time, and a buddy of mine, you know, we're standing in line, and some guy mentions it, and he says, oh, yeah, this guy's dad makes that stuff. They started buying me drinks like I was a god. It was hysterical. So anyhow, we sold all that stuff. He suckered me into the biz. You know, I came in, I looked at being a winemaker and decided I didn't really want to do that. So I'm going to go back to school, Pops. I'm going to get my PhD in literature. I'm going to teach it. He just sees the dollar signs going out the door. He's like, oh, grad school, great. So he said, listen, come work for me part-time. You know, it's a two-month gig. We just need – it's just a part-time position for 2 months. That's it. I'm in there a couple weeks. I'm all, 2 months? This doesn't seem to have an end on it. He's like, no, but you like it, right? And that's how I got started in the wine business. I was selling wine. I loved it. I was good at it.
What did you study in undergrad?
Oh, I was English – and philosophy major.
Okay. It's like, can't do anything, so you find something.
Yeah, that's it, right? You know? It's the most versatile degree, but it has no application other than you got to find somewhere to use your skills, be it verbally. Sure. And sales is good. Sure. You know, marketing, you understand, big picture, philosophy, all that stuff. It all fits in.
Sure. Wine, you know? Bacchus, it's
yeah.
literature.
It's all there, man. It's all there. And I just got a kick out of it. And I liked being around the biz. And it was competitive. I learned a lot. But I got tired of selling commodity stuff. Like Franzia box wines, you're competing against Gallo, you're competing against Canandaigua, so which is the Almaden brand, and then the Peter Vella brand. And it just got to the point where you would walk into a store, and I mean, this is, I'm speaking euphemistically, but you're opening your wallet up and saying, Mr. Retailer, what do you need? Mm-hmm. And it just, it sucked, you know. And I left, and I came back to California, and I started, I helped a guy start up, this wealthy gentleman who was really into wine, was a master chef, self-trained. And he loved French wines. And this was at the height. This was like back in 99. California wines were so oaky. You know, everybody was seeing how much new oak can we ferment it in new oak and then transfer it to new oak barrels? How much oak can we get on a wine? And over oaked wines are just not food friendly. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to bring in these small lot artisan crafted French wines that he had tasted. He'd been every 1, 2, 3-star Michelin restaurant in France. And they wanted to start this import company. So he sourced these wines. And some of the wines that he sourced were like cuvées, private cuvées, that he had bought through négociants to bottle up under the winery's label. And he asked me to do the same thing here in California. That's when I learned about the négociant business. Mm-hmm. I've been on the sales side. And there's no more divided business with the biggest Chinese wall ever than the wine business between sales and production. Sales has no idea what production does. There's very little interaction between the two. And sales certainly doesn't know how much it costs to make wine because the owners of the wineries don't want them to know. Because then they'd be back asking for more sales dollars, you know, more marketing, more advertising dollars. Because we're selling it for $18 a bottle, but it only costs $4 a bottle to make. Well, I should be able to get some more stuff. That's when I learned about the négociant side of the biz, mm-hmm. right? And when I went to do some private label projects, and we got some winemakers on a contract, and when they brought us the stuff and we tasted through it, I said, it costs how much? Mm-hmm. Holy cow. And that light went off over my head, the proverbial light bulb, and I'm like, geez. So after about 4 months, I said, guys, you know, I'm really not the guy to do this for you. And we all agreed. I mean, the position they wanted, I just wasn't fitting in there. And great people, I love them to death to this day. But I went my own way, and I sold off about 40 cases of wine that I'd collected on winebid.com. Nice. And I bought 500 cases of a Napa Cab blend. We were all into blending then. I had a brand called Synergy, C-I-N-E-R-G-I, and probably the ugliest packaging you've ever seen in your life. I mean, it was an experiment. We tried to get 12 circles on a bottle. All right, and they were all over the place. It was a mess. Anyhow, that's how I got into it. And the more we played around, the more we learned about getting the good stuff, what you need to do, where you need to be, how to get it. And it's definitely an art, and it's an insider game. Definitely an insider game. You got to learn the players and learn when people have stuff and when to go in. And you got to earn the relationship. The wine business is so relationship-driven from the sales side all the way down to production.
Just finding the gems alone. The same yeah. way. I mean, I've got a bottle of Rene Collard Rosé.
Yeah.
You know, and this is a guy who would sell to, like, Michelin stuff, but he retired, and all of his stuff has been sitting in his cellars for, like, the last 20 years or whatever, and some guys at K&L just happened to meet him.
Oh, really?
And, like, established a personal relationship with him. They're, yep. their champagne buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day, the guy's like, all right, I'll start selling you some of my personal stuff. And, it's incredible champagne.
Oh.
The guy made rosés, like, maybe 3 in the last 25 years or something, because he only made vintage rosés when they were really, really exceptional. And it's like, but these are wines from this guy's cellar that would have never got anywhere yeah. unless there was this relationship.
Yeah, you know? So and K&L is about as good as anybody
yeah.
at doing that.
Yeah.
That's good. Now, did you order that online from them? Or
yeah.
You
yeah.
get their catalog?
Yeah. I'm a champagne geek.
Uh-huh.
And so
I'm with you, brother.
Attention to
I'm
their,
with you.
Gary, their champagne uh-huh. buyer. I get Westby, I get all his stuff. And
yeah.
so
yeah.
if I see something that looks really interesting, and his palate has been pretty in tune with mine. So
they're as good as anybody.
Yeah.
They don't mess around with margin, K&L. So I recommend them to everybody. They're a phenomenal wine shop. I don't sell any wine to them.
Yeah.
So I can say that. They're probably the best place. And they work, you know, 25%.
Well, the thing is, they have so many things. Even in Chicago, with all the great wine stores that we have, there's a lot of stuff you just can't get that those guys get.
Yeah.
That's why, I mean, sure, I still go to Sam's and I go to wherever around here, but you know, they definitely have some interesting stuff.
I think they probably still have, I sold some wine to Sam's a while back, too. They probably still have some of my wine in there. Yeah.
Do you remember your first conscious glass of wine? Or?
I remember my transitional wine experience. It was a buddy and I were sitting on a rooftop. I went to school in Boulder, Colorado. It was just a gorgeous night. And my dad had sent me a couple bottles of Mitch Cosentino's wine. I think one of them was the Poet. One was a Pinot Noir and one was a Chardonnay. The Poet and the Sculptor, I think he called them. And they were high-end wines, and they were just dynamite. I mean, I was just, like, blown away by these wines. I forget what they were, actually, but the Pinot was just dynamite stuff. And that's when I was just like, I like this. And then I went to work. I tried to get a job in a wine shop in Boulder, but I graduated and just left. And I went back to Cal Poly to do their wine marketing seminars. And that's when I said, all right, I'm going to try and be a winemaker. But after working at a winery, a moderate production, Corbett Canyon, at the time it was still, you know, medium-sized facility. Now it's like they barely make any wine there. It's just all tasting room stuff. But after working there, seeing this guy sit behind a desk, you know, staring at tank charts all day, I'm like, that's not for me, man. And who had, you know, back then for $2 million, you could start up a winery.
Sure.
I guess you can't today. Just use custom crush facilities. But it wasn't what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what I wanted to do, quite frankly. That's when I wanted to go back to school. My old man suckered me out of that. Smartly so.
You know, people who do things for a business, you know, like my dad always talked about how my dad loves to fish. And I always said, well, why didn't you go in to be a commercial fisherman?
Right.
He always said, you know, if I had to do it as a job, it would ruin it for me.
Right.
You know, and
right.
I think that's true for some people. I wonder, are you still a wine lover? I mean, being so immersed in the business and all this, have you lost some of your passion, or is it still a thing for you?
Absolutely. I have a hard time lately in the last year finding time to really geek out on this stuff. So busy. I work 7 days a week right now, and I can't wait to get back into it more so. I do a lot of wine bars, a lot of tasting, keep up on what's going on. Like, you know, we want Albarino, Arias Bias. I want all that stuff, you know, Malbecs. And the sommeliers are first wave. Those guys, because they're experimental, they don't have to buy big. And that's wine bars are the best place to taste what's new, what's happening. Gewürztraminers, Rieslings. What's that? There's another grape coming out of Germany that is really hot, right? Grüner Veltliner. You know, there's a lot of stuff like that. Spain, it's got so much going on, and you wouldn't know these things unless you're in the wine bars tasting them. And experimental wine shops, but the wine bars are the best place to try this stuff. And so I try and get there as much as I can.
Yeah.
But no, you're right, man. You don't understand how busy this is to run a company.
Sure. Do you have an interest in this form of negociant is working well for you? Do you have any sense of you want to do more of the relationship stuff, like, you know, like a Kermit Lynch or like a Peter Wagant, where you go into France and you meet these people and you find these great wines? Do you want to expand into something?
Absolutely.
Like that?
The winery partnership model, where you kind of, in a way, I've been trying to figure out how to, like, co-brand what we do. Yeah, kind of like have a super label that represents folks like that, you know, and what's the word? Incubates killer winemakers. There's a guy's got a program. I forget the name of the winery, but he just sourced a bunch of winemakers around the globe and said, quality, go for it, whatever it costs. Get me the best stuff you can. And he's got this Oriel Wines, O-R-I-E-L, wine or wines.com, one of those two. And you'll see a neat portfolio that's totally global of winemakers. I think he tells you who the winemakers are. And they're from all over the globe. And, you know, Barolos all the way to Tempranillos in Spain, to Malbecs from Argentina. He's all over the place and got some really, really neat and interesting wines. We're interested in that. I've got a meeting at the end of the month here with an extremely talented winemaker who wins the Pinot Noir shootout year after year. He's been winemaker of the year, like three times running, set a record. I mean, the guy's dynamite. And he's just bored. He's like, you know, I'm working, I'm doing all these other things, and I want to get myself out of that situation, and I want to work with guys. So he's trying to set up like a few different clients. I want to have him make some killer wines for us, you know. So we'll get into the custom crush part. We got to do it slowly though, because it's extremely capital intensive.
Sure. ultimately the proof is in the pudding, and we're going to taste some of these in a second.
Yeah.
One of the things I think is interesting is the, I know there's been a lot, like even on like the Parker boards and things like that, about your Lot 7, Cabernet has sort of become...
That put us on the map.
That's kind of like a little legend there.
Yeah, that put us on the map. That was a Knights Valley cab that we hooked up, and... Until, you know, I was in and out with Costco. You know, they'd make me hang on for 2 months. We wouldn't be in there. And finally, we put Lot 7 in October, and it just made such a lot of noise. We sold 7,000 cases of wine in a matter of, like, a month. And through, like, 12 stores, they couldn't believe it. And people were coming in, grabbing 4 or 5 cases. And when it finally ran out, it was just like, oh, what happened? Where did it go? And so people were calling up corporate like, hey, you know, how do we get this stuff? And they're like, it's all gone. And so they called me in. And they said, okay, you know, what do we need to do to make this work better? And to get more wines into the pipeline, this and that. And they'd agree. They'd say, listen, when one's done, we're on to the next one. I was like, fine, great, let's go. And so they wanted to run with the program, and that's when we started expanding to Southern Cal, to San Diego, and now out here to Chicago.
So you still have a case of the 7 at home somewhere?
I have two.
Yeah.
I have two, and I get pinged virtually, well, it's 7, and Lot 3 was another famous one, the Petite Syrah, that people loved. And that was out of a single vineyard designate program from a winery that was going belly up. They've since been bought, so I can't get the juice anymore. But yeah, they just needed to slice off inventory. They just were hard up for cash.
Yeah.
Lot 3 was a big hit. Lot 7 was a big hit. And then Lot 13. Lot 13 was a Dry Creek cab with about 20% Napa Merlot. Just big, fat, rich. In fact, there were wine writers just going, I think one of them called it just said, spectacular, too much complexity for words. And here it is at $9.99 in Costco.
Uh-huh.
People couldn't get enough of it. Unfortunately, it was 2,200 cases in and out in a weekend. Boom, gone.
Literally how long, obviously it's the amount of cases that you can get and produce, but so you're going to be in Costco this weekend, 3 days or whatever,
yep.
3 different locations. How long would something last? You know, like how long are your, how
quickly depends on the store.
In?
You know, I've got stores that will blow out 3 pallets in a weekend when we send out an email, if not more. There's a couple stores in California that are like the number one wine stores. We're going to be probably, I think, they've put us into 3 of the best stores here, I imagine. So 2 pallets of wine per store. You figure you're selling probably on a Friday, you'll probably sell 30, 40 cases of wine. On Saturday, you'll sell 60 this time of year. Because people like to drink white wines, too, in August.
Sure.
It's hot out, you know. And it is Merlot. Cabernet, you can sell about an extra third over. Well, anyhow, I'm getting too into detail here. But at the end of the day, I'd say this wine will last through till next weekend.
Sure. So That's if you
it.
Like it.
You got to get
this
in.
This weekend, you got
to
get in.
Yeah, you got to get in. But we've got a lot more good stuff. The key is to get on the mailing list.
Right.
The website, chwine.com, and you just click on mailing list. And that's how we keep informed with everybody. We let them know where the wines are, when it's being released. In Northern Cal, if you don't catch it the first weekend, oftentimes you'll miss it. Some wines, though, we got, you know, I've got a Chardonnay coming. I got 12,000 cases of that stuff.
Sure.
That's
going
to last a month or two, if not more.
So, I mean, if there's one of these lots is just extraordinary and there people are paying $9.99, they're coming in and buying lots of cases, the next step seems that there might be a resale market out there. I'm curious if there's, like, any stories.
I haven't seen that yet. No, and I you know... We Google ourselves all the time to see what's happening, well, who's writing about us, and I've never seen our wines for sale on any of these websites. And guys, you know, they'll tell you, so I'm hanging on to it.
Sure.
You know, I don't think it's worth it.
Is there like a Lot 7 on eBay?
Yeah. You know, well, and the other thing is we don't go after Parker and the Spectator scores because they take too long to get. You know, and Parker now, I think, is at the point where he's only reviewing wines that are recommended to him by his network of brokers that he works with. It's hard to break in there.
Are you tempted to raise your price point? I mean,
well,
there's
no.
That much demand.
I, you know, we'll see how that goes. I'm open to stuff as we get more demand, but I suspect we're more likely to go out and get more lots. You know, because as we expand with Costco, the wines are going to get spread out over a thinner layer, so to speak. And they're going to go faster. So the idea is to get more lots in the pipeline and not raise prices, but just sell more wine. Right now, we're operating on a strict cost input. So whatever their input costs are, we mark up based off a percentage based off that.
Sure.
Yeah. So, no, there hasn't been. And, you know, my customers keep me honest. You know, they're just like, we're on email. Everybody's got my email address. They all know. They all talk to me. They all see me in the stores. And so they'll tell us, you know, like, come on, man. Don't be raising those prices. I'm sure when they see, because the Napa cab and the Stag Zeep Cab. I mean, these are Providence wines, man. Mm-hmm. They're from the highest end growing districts. They're going to go up over $10, and they'll be about $14.99 here in Chicago mm-hmm. for either one of these wines, or say $12.99, $13.99 out in California.
So we've got lot 14, 15, and 16. What else is on the market or in Chicago will be available?
Well, 50, all of these will come to Chicago. We're just getting started here. We're starting with 14. 15 won't make it here. There's mm-hmm. not enough of it. It's a small production. 16 probably will.
Okay.
And the 16 is probably the best of them all. Okay. It's the Stag's Leap Cab, and it is killer.
All right. Well, let's try some of these.
Okay, good. I just need one glass myself. And I opened these. This hopefully got some air. It was a little ragged from being bounced on the plane. And then, of course, they lost my luggage yesterday.
Really?
Yeah. And I was. They had priority tags on the luggage and everything because I managed to get myself upgraded. Because I'm flying a lot.
All right, so this is 14.
This is a Napa Valley Merlot. It's about 78% Rutherford fruit and about 22% Pope Valley Merlot. And then there's 5% Cabernet Franc blended in as well to flesh it out. And Rutherford Merlots don't need to be fleshed out very much, but it's pretty big, rich, full-bodied, muscular stuff.
Yeah, it reminds me, my father's a big Cabernet drinker when I was young, and those were some of the first wines I had. And this brings me back to my childhood, actually. It's got that bigness to it.
Yeah, they're rich, full-bodied. But they're refined, they're well-structured, super smooth, which is what this wine's all about.
Mm. So there's like some spiciness in there that hits like right at the beginning. It's good, though.
It goes and goes.
You're saying these be like more like 15?
No, this one will be $11.99.
This will be $11.99.
$11.99 till it's gone. They're probably only going to get one hit in this area.
Mm-hmm.
But it's food friendly. It's got great soft acids in there. Good structure. Oh, sorry. I'm sorry, man. I just talk breathlessly.
You know, that's fine. That's fine.
And a little spit cup.
It's good, man. I mean, for $11.99,
you can't beat it.
I'll be, you know.
You don't get stuff like this.
It's good.
But it just goes to show you. You know, it's all about the business model. Yeah. You know, and you got to find the lot program. I guess we should explain that. Each lot is a particular wine. It's a blend that we put together. Sometimes they're 5,000 in some cases. Sometimes they're 500. I've got lot 17, Sierra Foothills Barbera. 500 cases, that's it. That's all we got.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've got the Chardonnay at 12,000 cases in the Valley.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we number. We just number by lot to keep, and then we change the color on each of these to let everybody mm-hmm. know what's coming down the pike. Next up will be the Rutherford. And it says Napa on the label because it's only 66% Rutherford. Therefore, we don't enjoy the right to put mm-hmm. anything else on there. And then, again, about 16% Oakville, 18% Pope Valley. We love Pope Valley for blending grapes. You get really firm, tannic Cabernets and Merlot out of there. It's really rustic hillside stuff, but doesn't really have the terroir to make. You don't see a lot of single vineyard, or you don't see a lot of Pope Valley wines marketed, but it makes great blending. And it's 100% Cabernet.
Yeah, these are good wines. I mean, these are night and day from like T-Buck Chuck.
It's not the same. Yeah, exactly.
It's not.
No.
There's a lot of body. These are full. I mean, completely different. Completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worth it. I mean, because I think that was one of the things I was thinking about. It's like, well, why don't I go buy a $3 and $4 wine over a $10? You know, is it really any difference? But there is. There's a considerable difference.
Yeah.
And the value's there. I mean, these are $30 and $40 wines. It definitely tastes like something. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all there. And they've got aging potential. These are wines that need to be decanted at least an hour, all of them, which people should be doing with every young red. People do not decant enough in this business. You're missing out on so much. We had a Rioja the other day that... I didn't bother to decant, and by the end of the bottle, I'm like, damn it,
mm-hmm.
we should have let this one sit out, because mm-hmm. it just opened up completely. Young reds, you must decant.
Mm-hmm.
You got to decant them.
Mm-hmm.
End of story.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a craft that's been lost.
Yeah, no doubt
time,
about
you know,
it.
Especially, you know, especially.
Well, the patience factor. Everyone just wants to crack it and go.
Right. And if you're in a restaurant, you don't want to wait for it.
Yeah. Well, and restaurants are really challenging places to drink fine wine because of... You need somewhere quiet, man, to really enjoy a wine. It's got to be quiet. And there shouldn't be that many competing smells like the basil,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
In a restaurant, there's no more crowd. Your olfactory senses are so overloaded in a restaurant. There's just so much. There's heat. There's flesh. There's smells. You need some, you know, you need a... Oftentimes, I've had a lot of wines that were just overpowered by their environment.
Mm-hmm.
High-end stuff that just like, damn it, this was a waste, you know. Bordeaux in particular, aged Bordeaux, it just...
So this is lot 16. This is the 2004 Cabernet from Stag's Leap.
Mm-hmm.
It's got some like chalky mineral.
The fruit's a little hidden down in this wine. I don't know why, if they got beat up on the flight over here or what, but it's just starting to come out and play.
I think the 14 is my favorite, though, of the three.
You like them a lot?
I really like the one.
I like the 16. That's grown to be my favorite.
It's just such a low tannin Cabernet, but it still has great acid structure. It lifts out. It's voluminous in your mouth. It doesn't hit a particular spot. Wines that are out of balance, a wine should be, it's like an exploding tennis ball, you know, in your palate, in my opinion. And that's good structure. It should hit on all pistons in your mouth versus some wines that will tend to, they'll finish up high in your mouth or they'll finish down low. That's just bad structure. It's bad balance, bad pH. Mm-hmm. And every wine that we've put out so far, it's just hit that exploding tennis ball thing.
So the question I always ask, especially when I talk to chefs, is, you know, you're on death row, you know it's your last meal. You know, for a guy who's into wine, the question, of course, is, you know, what's the last glass or glasses?
Oh, man.
And, you know, I we're going to put the camera and he's aside because I'm sure you drink that, but let's be honest.
What is the to die for? See, the problem is I'm a helicopter thinker guy. You know, I'm big picture. I'm eclectic. I love tasting everything. To me, it's all about the newness of different things. And so it presents a real challenge to pick that last single, like what has been the most phenomenal bottle of wine. Hard to say. I had a great experience with a 91 Bonnie's Vineyard from Silver Oak that I thought just, you know, was just, I don't know whether it was the timing or what. I had a friend of mine for graduation gave me a Barolo. I can't even remember. I think it was like an 88 Barolo, something like that. That just was mind-blowing. Have I tasted anything that, we had a Schaefer Hillside Select the other day at 99 down in L.A. that a buddy of mine had been saving for a while. That was phenomenal. That was just to die for stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like asking which of your children is your favorite.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. It's like, for me, it's like, I'm all about just newness all the time.
Yeah.
What else is out there? What haven't I tried? What can I find? You know,
yeah,
that's what I like. I remember the first Albarino I had. I was like, oh man, this is cool.
Yeah,
this is great stuff. Or your first experience with a real, you know, Austrian Gewürztraminer.
Yeah,
that experience is like, wow, I didn't know that could be anything like this. It tastes like
Rieslings. I mean, that's the, you know, because you get the blue stuff or like the, you know, the super sweet. It's like almost like a really bad ice wine or something for so long. And then you have like a real good spot lease or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's just like
mind blowing.
Yeah. And then it's like, that's the wine for me. I'm going to keep trying.
And Riesling is for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, and I love white wine. I really do. I find I can't, when I'm really hanging out and wanting to have a good time, I just love drinking white wine.
Yeah.
It's just so much easier, more accessible. It's not as heavy as reds.
And I know it's easier to make money on the reds, I guess, but do you think it is.
White wines are much more margin impacted. Yeah. They're so much more competitive because it's all Chardonnay.
Sure.
You know, and there's everybody after that business.
And you'll have to get a kangaroo on your label.
I have to be honest. We're looking at, I've got some guys in Australia that, some old friends, and one of them has a buddy who has a really big wine facility over there, and they want to do a joint venture, and it's a critter label.
Yeah.
It's a nice critter label.
Of course.
Yeah. But with Chardonnay, it's that also your Chardonnay drinkers, the folks that are really into that in Costco, the guys that are coming in buying the KJ and the Acacia, they're not as adventurous as your red wine drinkers.
Mm-hmm.
Red wine drinkers tend to want to branch out. Yeah, they want to taste all sorts of new different stuff, so they're open to our program. So we've typically focused. We did lot number 4, which is a Chardonnay, and we haven't done a single white wine up until lot 20, mm-hmm. which is the Russian River Valley. And that'll come out here to Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the interview. Drop us feedback at mjnagran@hungrymag.com. Also, as you know, we are part of the Culinary Podcast Network, so you should check that out at culinarypodcastnetwork.com. See you next week, and stay hungry. Cool.
3, 2, 1 more time.